lift up the Son of Man so that we do not perish of desperation while bearing the burdens of our lives. Who could have possibly imagined such a daring concordance of idea and characterization? And how can it be that this pattern of identity has remained essentially implicit during all the centuries that separate us from the desert people of ancient Israel, and have still played such a central role? Whatever managed that feat of imaginative representation and characterization well deserves the place of honor due the transcendent and ineffable. The adventures of the Israelites continue ever more roughly after their baptism by serpent and God, with their constant engagement in the battles chronicled in the last third of Numbers. Numbers 21 details the initial defeat of some Canaanite tribes. The original inhabitants of the Promised Land were, however, a widespread people, kin to the Amorites, Moabites, and Midianites, all of whom also clashed with the invading Israelites, and all of whom suffer defeat, along with the Amalekites, Sionites, and Ogites, whose relations to or derivation from the Canaanites remains unknown. These multiple military victories buttress the Israelites in their belief that they could obtain the final triumph over those who stand in their way and occupy the Promised Land. The events that transpire around Balak, king of Moab, also increase their confidence while demoralizing their foes. Balak asks whether a Mesopotamian prophet, Balaam, might curse the Israelites as they advance. It seems quite clear that Balaam is regarded as a true man of God by moral reputation, and he is called on by the king precisely for that reason. As might be expected of such a man, Balaam warns the king that he will tell the truth, no matter how much he is paid or who is paying for his services. He nonetheless agrees to voyage with the princes of Moab to assess the situation, and the king accepts his offer. On the way, an angel appears to the Mesopotamian prophet, telling him that he can continue, reminding him once again that he is only to utter God's word, despite being in the employ of the king. Four times the prophet observes the Israelites. Four times he blesses them instead of cursing them, indicating as he does so the favor they have found with God, noting their numerous nature, their lack of iniquity and perverseness, Numbers 23:21, the plentifulness of their tabernacles, Numbers 24:5, and their future victoriousness. He hath said, which heard the words of God and knew the knowledge of the Most High, which saw the vision of the Almighty falling into a trance, but having his eyes open. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies, and Israel shall do valiantly. Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that remaineth of the city. Numbers 24:16-19. The blessing of the Israelites occurs despite Balak's attempts to tempt Balaam with increased pay and the seductive offerings of the king's own daughters. The Israelites continue their habit of straying along the way, stopping in Shittim, part of the Moabite kingdom of Balak, to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab, Numbers 25:1, who tempt them into the worship of Baal. This disloyalty results in the predictable dissatisfaction of God and an accompanying plague, yet another punishment meted out by the divine forces opposed so carelessly by the chosen people. Numbers 26 follows, portraying the second census of the book. The first is described in Numbers 1. The text continues and extends the sociology and technical assessment of the state, detailing the division of labor and social organization among the Israelites, describing their segregation, differentiation, and specialization into the slaves, farmers and shepherds, soldiers, merchants, craftsmen, musicians, judges, and priests that make up the state. This identifying and sifting is all part of a developing and advancing self-consciousness, the beginning of a formal typology and analysis of individual and society alike. The beginnings, as indicated previously, of the formally analytic mode of observation, description, thought, and record that we now take for granted. It is all part of the continued development of the subsidiary structure of the new nation, including its capacity to represent and monitor itself. In Numbers 27, God provides Moses with a final reward for his faithful service, despite his being barred from the promised land. It appears to be granted in response to Moses' direct request, as recounted later in Deuteronomy 3:25. I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain, and Lebanon. God tells the prophet to scale Mount Abarim, the last of the sequential pinnacles climbed in the course of Moses' storied life, so that he can see the land which I have given the children of Israel, Numbers 27:12. This adventure is tempered somewhat in its positive aspect, as God simultaneously lets his prophet know of his impending demise. Is it possible to imagine Moses satisfied with all that he has done? He has destroyed a tyrant, provided his people with a vision of freedom and responsibility, led them through the desert, chastised, protected, and interceded for them when they fell prey to temptation, and helped them to establish a truly functional and victorious state. Is this an example of the aforementioned possibility that a fully lived life justifies itself, rife with tragedy and error though it may be, ending in death, though it inevitably does? Moses appoints the faithful and courageous Joshua as his successor after God shows him the promised land and does so before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, Numbers 27. It is thus that the great prophet appoints and specifies his successor, ensuring a peaceful transfer of power. After this, as is appropriate, the details of the covenantal law are reviewed, Numbers 28-30. This specifies the proper continuity of tradition and contract that are to govern the tenure of the new ruler, as they did in the time of Moses. Immediately thereafter, a terrible war, difficult to justify in its ruthlessness, is waged on the Midianites, Numbers 30. The Israelites bring home the spoils, which includes the Midianite women. Moses angrily chastises his soldiers. Have ye saved all the women alive? Behold, these caused the children of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. And there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. Numbers 31:15-16. He calls on them to put all the female captives except the virgins to the sword, and has the same done to all the Midianite boys. It is sections such as these, following hard on the heels of the death of the 3,000, the opening up of the earth under Korah, the plagues attendant upon those who consort with the whores of Moab, that give the modern reader convinced of his or her comparative moral virtue great pause. Is all this violence nothing but a clear indication of the vengefulness and jealousy of an archaic and blindly superstitious people's god? Dr. Richard Dawkins makes that case without hesitation. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. This is clearly a motivated misreading on the part of the evolutionary biologist, at least insofar as the interpretations of the present text are both sympathetic and accurate, to say nothing of the entire history of Jewish and Christian apologetics. However, the moral difficulties posed by the current text arguably remain. Does it suffice to claim that the danger posed by the incorporation of many foreign women, whose capacity to entice, seduce, convert, and seriously sicken the Israelites has already been demonstrated, was too great to bear, and that Moses could see this clearly? Can the same be said about the potential danger posed by the Midianite boys? Did these captives represent a possible future fifth column and source of destabilization? It is not clear under what conditions we can rightly apply our hypothetically higher moral standards to the societies of the past, laboring as they did under conditions of privation, threat, and difficulty almost and fortunately unimaginable to us. It is very easy for us to perceive ourselves as better than our forebears, to damn them for their vicious proclivities, and to assume that we would and should act better in the same situation. But it is also too easy to rationalize away actions such as those undertaken in the war against the Midianites, and to assume the events so described are not to be taken literally, to insist uncritically and merely as a matter of blind and self-justifying faith that God's word must be followed even if the commands seem cruel and unjust, and to therefore sidestep the eternal problem of trying the spirits in the presence of many false prophets and prophecies to see if they are of God, 1 John 4:1. But we are trying to extract out a universal thread of moral gold by walking through these ancient stories. And the bitter parts of the biblical corpus must be swallowed along with the sweet. Under what conditions is killing justifiable, necessary, or even morally obligatory? How do we deal with the fact that war and everything brutal that inevitably accompanies it is a universal feature of our past and present struggles forward? How can we conceptualize ourselves as essentially admirable moral agents, as intrinsically good beings, given our universal proclivity for intertribal conflict, given the existence of the powerful motivations that operate within us, sweeping us toward the gun and the sword, when our borders, our axioms, our families, our tribes are under threat, or are at least convincingly deemed so? Virtually everyone understands, accepts, and promotes the right to self-defense, as well as the analogous and extended right and responsibility to protect kith and kin. Under what circumstances does obligation to the local, the familial, the tribal, supersede that owed to a stranger, an enemy, a man or a people who were once an enemy? It is murder per se, and not killing, that is forbidden by the sixth commandment. And murder has been held since time immemorial to be something different than war. These are all questions that are among the most difficult we face in our wrestling with the divine. The classic justifications for the slaying of the Midianites take two traditional forms. The first is that such actions were typical for the times, when the utter destruction of a conquered enemy was regarded as necessary to protect against the influence they might otherwise retain and wield. Such actions, and their understanding or rationalization, is based on the presumption that the presence of foreigners and the ideas they bear can pose a threat to the integrity of the psyche and the state. Why? Because the conflict between their fundamental presuppositions and those of the conquerors is the very war of the gods that can undermine and bring down a state. It is therefore something very common, and perhaps biologically hardwired, to regard foreign ideas as pathogens that can invade, spread, and kill. A stout conservatism is very likely to make itself manifest, for example, in locales that are typified by the heightened presence of transmissible disease, a fact indicating the essential psychological identity between the strange idea and the predator and parasite. The second justification is more subtle. The Midianites are seen as being in league with the Moabites, who were presented in Numbers 25 as inviting the Israelite men to indulge in sexual immorality with the daughters of Moab, Numbers 25:1, and to the sacrifices for their gods, which included Baal, twin offerings that were positively responded to by the invitees, Numbers 25:2. The consequences? The anger of the Lord burned against them, Numbers 25:3. There are reasons to be concerned with what is foreign that are so deep that we have adapted biologically to their presence. It is equally the case, however, that what is strange and new, as in the case of the beneficial foreigner, as outlined previously, can be a saving grace, both practically and metaphysically. It is no small matter that Jethro, Moses' admired and beloved father-in-law, who saved him from becoming a tyrant and saved the Israelites from reestablishing their slavery, was also a Midianite, and therefore from the same foreign tribe that is now presented as a deadly threat. This is another case of the paradoxical ultimate reality of treasure in concert with dragon. How then do we deal with the all too often repressed and unspoken fact that the presence of oft foreign threats, real or imagined, can awaken within us a powerful longing for mayhem, a lust for battle, a self-righteous and murderous clamoring for blood, and the accompanying enthusiastic demonization of anyone who, under such circumstances, dares argue for peace? How do we separate out our right to self-defense in its immediate and broader senses from our Cain-like desire to find a target upon whom we can release all our pent-up existential frustration, resentment, bitterness, arrogance, and cruel vengefulness? How do we understand and atone for the atrocities of history, the territorial expansions that are part of the historical record of virtually every people, and the participation of our ancestors and ourselves in the wars that have both marred and made our present what it is today? How do we atone for the privilege bestowed upon us, not least as a result, however partial, by the blood spilled by guilty and innocent alike in the past? How do we sacrifice properly, singly and communally, for the sins of those who came before us and which are all too likely to manifest again with dreadful suddenness whenever the conditions are right? Striving to answer such questions is the dreadful necessity of wrestling with God. There is an alternative view to the damning modern characterization of the ancient Old Testament or Torah God of the Judeo-Christian tradition. It is stark and simple in its portrayal of reality, although still undeniably bitter. Perhaps it is all the more believable because of that. Consider that there are a million paths of deviation, detour, and defection, and very few, perhaps one, that enable effective, efficient, productive, generous, and unified movement forward. Consider as well that the punishment of natural consequences, even, for such deviation can be, and too often, is catastrophic suffering and mass death. Speaking pragmatically and non-theologically, why then must the capturing of this brutal truth in the characterization of God be interpreted as the will of something with malevolent intent? The path chosen by the National Socialists, the Soviets, and the Maoists was one that deviated seriously, to say the least, from the injunctions of the Judeo-Christian tradition. The fate that descended upon the people of those cultures as a direct result was as terrible as anything represented as the vengeance of the Old Testament's angry God. Non-playable games degenerate first into chaos and then into hell. This reflects something akin to the consequences of transgressing against the underlying moral order of the cosmos. Is it so surprising and so morally unacceptable that the inevitable outcomes, part of the pattern of the cause and effect that most truly characterizes the world, especially from the scientific perspective, might come to be understood and portrayed as the jealousy of God? Might it come to be represented as well or alternatively as his insistence that nothing and no one except him is to be elevated to the status of highest place? If everything necessarily and inescapably tumbles into the abyss when certain strictures are violated, is it not an act of mercy, not of malevolence, to indicate precisely that beforehand? And how could it conceivably be any other way? In a world characterized by the existence of free will, genuine reality, and true and irreducible import of human action, if we have important things to do, and the unrestrained capacity to choose to do them or not, and if such choices determine the manner in which reality unfolds, and whether the order that is good or even very good makes itself manifest, then our poor choices will also have their consequences, as dire in error as they are good in faithful service. Moses makes the dreadful decision that the Midianite captives cannot be incorporated into Israelite society without undue risk. They are therefore put to the sword, and the Israelites proceed to the conclusion of their long, trying, and momentous journey. Whether this is the fault of the desert sojourners, their Midianite enemies, sin, or God himself, is something that we remain confused about to this day. It is perhaps the case that the permanent solution to this conundrum of threat versus opportunity or protection versus oppression is the specification of and then practice of diligent upward aim. Whether a foreign agent is deemed a welcome and necessary deliverer or ultimate foe is going to forever remain a matter of judgment, a matter that would be best served by the counsel of wisdom. It is the eternal hope of the religious striver that those who formulate a covenant with what is highest and divine will also become precisely those who are wise, those who are best able to separate, once again, wheat from chaff and sheep from goats. This might mean that the best we can hope for when called upon to determine what is appropriate in our relationship with what is foreign is that we have developed the sagacity and judgment of those who walk with God, and that in consequence the appropriate decision is made at the appropriate time. And with that, essentially, Numbers ends. The book of Deuteronomy opens with a retelling of the Exodus Numbers story. Moses, weary after all this strife, facing the end of the road, delivers a lengthy bout of thunderous declaiming to his people, a summation of his times and teaching, Deuteronomy 1-30. He closes that with an announcement of the end of his days. I am 120 years old this day. I can no more go out and come. Also, the Lord has said unto me, thou shalt not go over this Jordan. Deuteronomy 31:2-3. He tells the Israelites they will continue to travel in God's company under the guidance of their new leader. The Lord thy God, he will go over before thee, and he will destroy these nations from before thee, and thou shalt possess them. And Joshua, he shall go over before thee, as the Lord hath said. 31:3. Moses encourages them to maintain their faith despite this transition of leadership. Be strong and of a good courage. Fear not, nor be afraid of them. For the Lord thy God, he it is that doth go with thee. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. 31:6. He then directly addresses his successor, handing to him the reins of authority, encouraging him as well. And Moses called unto Joshua and said unto him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of a good courage, for thou must go with these people unto the land which the Lord hath sworn unto their fathers to give them, and thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he it is that doth go before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. 31:7-8. This is another marker of the excellence of the now aged prophet's leadership. He takes pains to ensure that the man who takes his place is worthy, ready to do so, and blessed by his predecessor. God tells Moses that the Israelites will again lose faith in the future, break the divine covenant, and suffer dreadfully in consequence. He tells his prophet to write a song to be sung in the future to remind the all too often wayward chosen people of their faith and the eternal existence of the promised land. And it shall come to pass, when many evils and troubles are befallen them, that this song shall testify against them as a witness, for it shall not be forgotten out of the mouths of their seed. For I know their imagination which they go about, even now, before I have brought them into the land which I swear. Moses therefore wrote this song the same day and taught it the children of Israel. 31:21-22. This song contains the final words of Moses to the people he has led for so long. It opens with the following verses of remembrance. Give ear, O ye heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. My doctrine shall drop as the rain. My speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb, and as the showers upon the grass. Because I will publish the name of the Lord. Ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He is the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment, a God of truth and without iniquity. Just and right is he. They have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation. Do ye thus requite the Lord, O foolish people and unwise? Is not he thy father that hath bought thee? Hath he not made thee and established thee? Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father, and he will shew thee, thy elders, and they will tell thee. Deuteronomy 32, 1-7. And with that, the greatest of the Old Testament prophets reviews once again the destination of his people high above the plains of Moab and goes to meet his Maker. And Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto the mountain of Nebo to the top of Pisgah that is over against Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead unto Dan, and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah unto the utmost sea, and the south, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, unto Zoar. And the Lord said unto him, This is the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab over against Beth Peor. But no man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day. And Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. And Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands upon him, and the children of Israel hearkened unto him, and did as the Lord commanded Moses. And there arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, in all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and in all that mighty hand, and in all the great terror which Moses shewed in the sight of all Israel. Deuteronomy 34, 1-12. Chapter 9. Jonah and the Eternal Abyss. We know nothing about Jonah when we're introduced to him. We might infer that there is nothing remarkable about him, that he is as ordinary and unknown as any other man, until he hears the voice of God. Now the word of the Lord came unto Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness is come up before me. Jonah 1:1-2. Why Jonah? This is a question echoed by everyone required by circumstance to undertake a singular duty or bear a rare existential burden. Why me, God? What have I ever done to deserve such a fate? But our destinies call to each of us, not least in the form of what interests us or gets under our skin, despite our wishing it might be otherwise. Why Nineveh? This is an equally complex question. It is a city obviously known to Jonah. Otherwise, it would not make much sense for God to direct his potential servant's attention to it. Nineveh is inhabited by the sworn enemies of Israel, and by no means a place that Jonah would be inclined to consider in a kindly fashion. The kingdom of Israel was conquered by the Neo-Assyrian monarchs Tiglath-Pileser III and Shalmaneser V, and later by Sargon II and his son Sennacherib. The same Assyrians carried out a policy of forced resettlement of Israelites, with those so moved coming to be known as the 10 Lost Tribes. See 2 Kings 17, 3-6. Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. The unfolding story therefore makes it quite clear that the erstwhile prophet would be thoroughly pleased to see the people of Nineveh go to hell in precisely the handbasket of their own making. Thus, not only did God call upon Jonah to face down a whole city on his own and a degenerate, terribly misbehaving city at that, he asked him to preach to his own people's sworn enemies and hypothetically save them from the destruction that, in his prophet's opinion, they richly and justly deserved. It is the same still small voice that spoke to Elijah that calls upon Jonah, suggesting that he journey alone to a hated foreign city to face down its tens of thousands of inhabitants, none of whom have any reason to bear anything but enmity toward him. In short, he is called by the divine to work at immense risk to save those he hates from punishment from Jonah's own God, which he thinks should be visited upon them sooner rather than later, and with all the intensity that God could muster. Is it any wonder, then, that Jonah does what any sensible person might do upon hearing God's apparently far from reasonable request, making tracks as rapidly as possible in the precisely opposite direction? But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord and went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare thereof and went down into it to go with them unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Jonah 1:3. It was literally not possible to get any farther away from Nineveh than Tarshish at the time. Jonah's dilemma is reminiscent of that confronted by a great man of an entirely different culture, the Greek philosopher Socrates, when he faces his final ordeal. Socrates had been diligently instructing the people of his city, Athens, to think. Was he in fact the world's first genuinely expert thinker? Was that very capacity for thought the same as the emergence of the inner voice? There were plenty of powerful people in Athens who were not happy about that enterprise or its fruits. Those same people accused him of both failing to acknowledge the gods recognized by the city and corrupting the city's youth, crimes punishable by death. They threatened Socrates, in consequence, with a public trial. To his enemies' credit, they warned him of their plans. A sensible man would have regarded this as a clear message: get out of Dodge City or else. The popular philosopher had clearly annoyed some powerful people. They were not inclined to murder him on the street or in his bed, not unless such action became necessary. But they were perfectly willing to let him know that bad things were coming his way if he failed to vanish. Socrates gives great consideration to his situation, conferring intensely with his daemonian, his muse, or inner voice. He had heard and attended to this voice since childhood, according to his own testimony, and it guided him away from harm and toward the immense virtue he embodied and promoted. Terribly enough, when met with the threat of the trial, the daemonian tells Socrates not to run. It advises him instead to stay and enter the fray, and, if necessary, to take his bitter medicine. He tells his friends and admirers about this decision. They are, as might be expected, none too pleased. The relevant text, Credo, details a conversation between the man of the dialogue's name and Socrates. The former has made arrangements to smuggle the old philosopher out of prison and into exile, where he will be safe. All things considered, that would be better for Socrates as well as his sons and friends, who might otherwise look and feel like they did nothing to help him, and would be, in addition, a set of actions leading to a more just outcome. Furthermore, arrangements have been made by those same friends to provide the great teacher with a comfortable retirement. Socrates rejects all these plans and pleas, indicating instead that a citizen owes allegiance to the laws of his state, however unjust a given application of those laws might be, a rationale in keeping with the statements of his inner voice. He remains famously in Athens, undergoes the trial promised by his foes, and makes a terrible hash of their reputation while on the stand. It is clear from the accounts of the hypothetical prosecution why the philosopher was unpopular with the elite. He turns the trial on its ear, telling those who are there to see him finished exactly what he thinks of them and why, in the most public manner possible. Unlike Jonah, Socrates devoutly followed the dictates of his conscience and says to his enemies what he has been called upon to say. He has been remembered ever since, at least in part because of that awful courage whose expression cost him his life. Is it reasonable to do so? Is this the path that a good God would ask his followers to walk? It is very easy at the beginning of this story to sympathize with Jonah, the reluctant prophet, unwilling as he was to make the choice of Socrates. It is no surprise that he is loath to follow even a divine prompting, given the impossibility of his situation. How are we to make sense of this apparently ignorant command, particularly given God's omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence? What exactly does Jonah's problem signify? First, perhaps, this. We all, no matter how hypothetically ordinary, face challenges, obstacles, and calls to duty in our lives that seem too much to bear. Thus, the idea that God sometimes presents ridiculous demands upon us appears existentially sound, even if secularized, even if conceptualized as sometimes life is simply too much. Second, perhaps this. Everyone knows, at least at a level appropriate for their current state of development, what is right and what is wrong. Everyone knows when it is their duty to set things right when they see them going wrong and to risk themselves in that attempt, not least because it is a clear risk to let things deteriorate, not least because of their obligations to the future and to others. This setting right, this confronting of the crisis, can be a dangerous task, however, in the short term, can present a practical and psychological challenge, can set the would-be speaker against the rough and immediate judgment of the mob. There is something of an eternal contest to shirk responsibility, however necessary it might be, to let someone else be the sacrificial voice in the wilderness, to hide unwanted things in the fog, to pretend that what is wrong is unimportant, to rationalize and prevaricate, to claim the moral virtue of false compassion, to turn a blind eye to growing viciousness, to hide from reality and destiny, even though such hiding also means the foregoing of adventure itself. This is part of the attractiveness of the lie, which can so often be silence rather than the sin of commission that is outright manipulation or deception. Keeping quiet when threat is near has the obvious short-term advantage of safety and security. But there's the rub. There is much that works well for now and for the narrowly selfish that compromises the future and the community. Perhaps the voice of conscience is part of the spirit that sees all, that can navigate past, present, and future simultaneously, and that unites the individual with the group. This, at least, is the insistence of text and tradition. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the ending, saith the Lord, which is, and which was, and which is to come, the Almighty. Revelation 22:13. Jonah has been told by God in no uncertain terms that the people of Nineveh have deviated from the proper path in a serious manner and that they are threatened with divine apocalypse in direct consequence. The erstwhile prophet knows full well that this is true, that it has become his personal problem, and that it is his proper and ordained destiny to say what he has to say, and the devil takes the hindmost. But as a sensible but insufficiently God-fearing person might, he rejects the call. And what happens when such responsibility is abdicated? The winds blow and the waves rise up, and the eternal ship of soul and state itself is threatened. But the Lord sent out a great wind into the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that the ship was like to be broken. Then the mariners were afraid and cried every man unto his God, and cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea to lighten it of them. But Jonah was gone down into the sides of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep. So the shipmaster came to him and said unto him, What meanest thou, O sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God, if so be that God will think upon us, that we perish not. Jonah 1:4-6. Jonah's sleeping during this crisis is a re-representation of the theme of his fleeing, except this time he is retreating from the realities and demands of the current situation by escaping into unconsciousness, just as Cain did previously when he is banished to the land of Nod in the aftermath of Abel's murder, just as Peter and the rest of the disciples do much later, Matthew 26:36-46, when asked to stay awake and accompany Christ during his intense suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane. It is no wonder that the shipmaster is displeased, as is Jesus in the garden. What dutiful man sleeps when there is a catastrophe unfolding? We are often called upon by our consciences, by our higher selves, in the psychologized but somehow secularly acceptable parlance, to speak or act when the most craven parts of us would rather remain silent. We are often called upon to maintain an alert wakefulness, just when we might desperately crave the bliss of non-being, temporary or permanent. The situation of storm, peril, and unconsciousness is paralleled elsewhere in Christ's life, with a very different immediate outcome. And when he was entered into a ship, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. And his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we perish. And he saith unto them, Why are ye fearful, O ye of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. But the men marveled, saying, What manner of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him? Matthew 8:23-27. Instead of being cast into the sea as a consequence of the storm, and more distally, as a result of rejecting God's word, the man who is the word itself has no need to be taken involuntarily into the depths. He speaks his word of love and truth conjoined, and the waters that threaten the eternal ship calm. The sailors transporting Jonah have an intuition that they have taken on board someone not right with the divine. They throw dice, essentially, just to test their hypothesis, reasoning that the loser will be the one indicated as out of favor with the proper order of being itself. Jonah is the unlucky but deserving recipient of that honor. And they said everyone to his fellow, Come, and let us cast lots, that we may know for whose cause this evil is upon us. So they cast lots, and the lot fell upon Jonah. Jonah 1:7. The fleeing captive then makes his situation worse, if possible, by stressing the power of the God he purports to worship, describing him in the highest possible terms as the ultimate creator of the cosmos itself. This further terrifies the already frightened seamen, not least because Jonah had previously let his dispute with that very God become public. Weighted down, perhaps by his conscience, he informs on himself, letting his ocean-going compatriots know that he was fleeing an order delivered from the highest possible place, implying, as he did, no doubt about the credibility of the source, and an unwillingness to shoulder the risk attendant upon complying with the command. Then they said unto him, "Tell us, we pray thee, for whose cause this evil is upon us? What is thine occupation, and whence comest thou? What is thy country, and of what people art thou?" And he said unto them, "I am an Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, which hath made the sea and the dry land." Then were the men exceedingly afraid, and said unto him, "Why hast thou done this?" For the men knew that he fled from the presence of the Lord, because he had told them. Jonah 1:8-10. To his credit, however, in this dire situation, honesty returns to Jonah, and he offers himself up as a sacrifice to save the ship and its sailors, entreating them to throw him overboard so that he might drown and they survive. Then they said unto him, "What shall we do unto thee, that the sea may be calm unto us?" For the sea wrought and was tempestuous. And he said unto them, "Take me up and cast me forth into the sea, so shall the sea be calm unto you, for I know that for my sake this great tempest is upon you." Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to bring it to the land, but they could not, for the sea wrought and was tempestuous against them. Jonah 1:11-13. We can infer from his truthfulness and emergent willingness to sacrifice himself in the throes of a genuine crisis that Jonah was a basically good man, despite his understandable situational cowardice. Maybe it was for this reason that the voice of conscience descended upon him in the first place. Failing in their attempts to make for the safe haven of shore, the sailors relent, however reluctantly, and decide to go through with the necessary sacrifice. Wherefore they cried unto the Lord and said, "We beseech thee, O Lord, we beseech thee, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not upon us innocent blood. For thou, O Lord, hast done as it pleased thee." So they took up Jonah and cast him forth into the sea. And the sea ceased from her raging. Jonah 1:14-15. The sea immediately calms. Their ship is saved. This convinces the men of God's ultimate dominion, and they turn their worship toward him, promising to maintain that attitude on a permanent basis. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice up to the Lord and made vows. Jonah 1:16. Does the threat posed to the ship not signify that those who refuse their divine calling threaten the state itself? Does this not indicate that those who run and hide must be admonished by themselves and the community? Even that the domination of sin will become so complete and dire as a consequence of such refusal that even those initially unwilling to discriminate, judge, and reject will be driven by emergent necessity to do so as everything shakes and creaks around them. What is the alternative? How can sanity prevail, stability maintain itself, and adaptation proceed if the individuals who make up the state reject the responsibility they know full well in their heart of hearts to be theirs? If they refuse to make what they know beyond a shadow of a doubt public knowledge? If they hold their tongue when something necessary and vital burns to be said? What is the moral of the story of Jonah so far? Speak truth to the mad urban mob at your great peril. But fear even more the God who tells you to speak when you have something to say. Maintain silence when called upon to testify, and pay the price. The tempest will rise, and the waves will tower ever higher until the very ark that protects you from chaos itself will be imperiled. Then your compatriots, in their desperation, will abandon you to the tender mercies of the darkest and deepest waters, and you will swim or perish. And that is not yet enough. As you find yourself in peril of drowning, a terrible monster will arise from the abyss itself and haul you down to the very bottom of the world. It is no coincidence that the 3 days that Jonah spends in the belly of the whale are symbolically paralleled to the hell that Christ himself harrows in the aftermath of his crucifixion. Degeneration, destruction, and death will threaten in the aftermath of rejection of the divine call to voice. But that is not all. Such threat will be followed by a fate so terrible that death itself will be viewed as a most desirable alternative. Drowning is one thing, bad as it is. Hell is a whole different kettle of fish. And what does this mean? Someone who has lived truly rarely fails to understand that there are worse things than mere cessation of being. Compliance with the authorities in Auschwitz was worse than death. Life as a trustee in the Soviet Gulag was worse than death. Acting as an agent hell-bent on the destruction of the innocents is worse than death. Hell is much worse than death. And those who insist that hell does not exist know little of history and utterly lack informed imagination. The spirit that creates hell is that of malevolence itself, that bitter combination of envy, spite, arrogance, deceit, disdain, and resentment, that endless longing of the Luciferian intellect to usurp, replace, and sit on the highest seat. It is far easier to believe in the reality of that spirit than to profess the allegiance to God, which requires courage despite suffering, humility despite pride, gratitude instead of resentment, discipline instead of an immature narcissism multiplied in its pathology by a blind and narrowly self-serving hedonism, and, of course, the self-sacrifice demanded, say, by the true followers of Christ. Why is the terrible truth that Jonah is called upon to utter something that places him in peril? Well, first of all, that is not what it is. It is something that temporarily places him in peril, but that redeems him and everyone else in the fullness of time. Galatians 4:4. Why should we presume anything other than that the deepest instincts that orient us speak with what is in our best interest in mind, all things considered and over the longest possible span of time and community, even if there is a price to be paid for that, a sacrifice to be made in the present? Second, it is obvious that there is going to be danger in confronting the accrued consequences of a misaligned aim of sin, given that there were at least micro reasons for the acts of avoidance, omission, and outright deception, commission, that aggregated the trouble in the first place. If a building is not maintained, then the work required to do so not only adds up, but multiplies, as one damn thing leads not only to another, but to a teeming multitude of others. And they came over unto the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces. Neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him and cried with a loud voice and said, What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not. For he said unto him, Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And he asked him, What is thy name? And he answered, saying, My name is Legion, for we are many. Mark 5:1-9. This means that Jonah and all of those called to speak truth to power, to employ a phrase mouthed to death by the Pharisees of the modern world, will inevitably be required to face all the perils that have accrued through sin. Of course, this is dangerous, and ineluctably so. It was from the minor dangers that originally existed, to say it again, that all the sinners who aggregated that danger were originally attempting to flee. This cost them the opportunity to participate in the great and true romantic adventure of their miserable lives. But what is it? Better the devil you know than the God you know not. This is malevolence itself. In each of the micro actions or inactions that created the cumulative hell, in that hell itself, and in the form of the cowardly, resentful, and arrogant spirit that motivated each sinful act or failure to act. And it is something far easier to believe in than God, given the self-imposed terrors of human history. Those who insist that hell does not exist are either willfully blind or so fortunate and protected by a benevolent fate that they have not visited that dread domain long enough to learn the terrible lessons that are learned there. Through the darkness, however, and into the light. This is also what Jonah learns. It is not until he has descended into the hell that also characterizes both the situation of the Ninevites, but also the spirit that led them there, that he truly confronts the reality of God. What does this mean? That the stark reality of evil is perhaps the most compelling evidence for God? How could this be? If it is true that evil exists, and if the reality of this truth becomes self-evident, once evil has been encountered and seen for what it is, then the opposite of evil is something equally real, even in the mere form of the contrary direction, even in the ineffable form of the alternative to the journey to hell. If there is a pathway to the abyss, our direction on that road can be reversed. Why should we assume that there is any difference between getting as far away from Satan as possible and climbing Jacob's ladder? Or are we somehow willing to admit that only hell truly exists, once again, say, in the form of the trustee in Auschwitz or the Soviet gulag who enjoys the delights of his power, in the form of the veritable devil who takes pleasure in sticking the prongs of his pitchfork in others, even if it means submitting himself in turn to the even larger pitchforks of the even bigger devils who inevitably rule over him? Only hell, then, and some idiot neutrality, a land where neither good nor evil live, the equally damned land of the fence-sitter, is the final destination of those who turn without reservation away from the idiot blandishments of Satan in the desert. We have been specifically warned against such an assumption by none other than Christ himself in the terrible form of the judge at the end of times. I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou wert cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm, and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Revelation 3:15-16. Or is it instead the case, as was intimated to Tolstoy, that the infinite expanse above us towers as high as the terrible abyss below us endlessly gapes? Is it not also the case that the reality of God and the necessity of the strictest of obedience is revealed to us in consequence of the hardness of our hearts, not in what beckons to us in the form of calling, or even warns us in the form of conscience, but in the most dire moments of our life, made dire by the very consequences of our Jonah-like attempts to run away and hide? There is more yet to the devouring monster of the riff than mere beast and underworld, something individual and social, in addition to natural and abysmal or hellish. That more is part of the strange juxtaposition of image and idea that is so characteristic of the dreamlike thought of thoroughly distilled story. The terrible Leviathan of the deep is the maw of Hades, but at the same time something alive and immensely valuable. A creature of that size is an intrinsically useful commodity. It is precisely for that reason that whales have been hunted by human beings for thousands of years. At its peak in the mid-19th century, the whaling industry was the fifth largest commercial enterprise in the U.S. and was a major contributor to the burgeoning Industrial Revolution, which relied on the fuel, bone, meat, and keratin products derived from the great denizens of the deep. The fact of this value of carcass is part of the complex of meaning that surrounds the idea of the whale. Herding people calculate their wealth by the size of their herds and flocks, by the weight of the bodies of the animals they care for and live off. And there is simply no body larger than that of a giant cetacean. Thus, the whale that devours Jonah is also both a storehouse of immense value and one of the most potent symbols of such a storehouse. This means, surprisingly enough, at least on first encounter, that there is an equivalence between the giant corpses of whales and the traditions and institutions bequeathed to us by our ancestors, a similarity highlighted by such turns of phrase as body of law, of knowledge, and of wisdom. These are also treasure houses, place where accrued value is deposited and kept. The great bodies in question, whether of the living or institutional type, are also similar in that their stored value is a product of forces beyond the immediate control of those alive in the present. In the case of the institutional type, think social capital. Those forces are the productive cooperative activities of the people who left more behind them than they consumed, so their children and others' children could benefit. In the case of the living type, think natural resource, the bestowing agent is nature rather than culture, although nature always lurks behind the cultural and the social, and can be properly regarded as the more distal source, even of what is economic and communal. Regardless of source, the same endpoint is reached. Something is left for the using, preserving and enriching, or for the mere taking. Wise societies, composed of grateful and awake people, live in conscious appreciation for what has been given to them and attempt to pay the favor forward. A carcass the size of a whale is indeed the most salient possible direct embodiment and representation of the accrued value that is in its most fundamental form a storehouse of food and energy. The man fortunate enough to stash a whale in his storehouse, if he can only preserve and keep it, is someone provisioned as well as possible against all but the most extreme of conceivable famines. And what if the whale has only washed up on shore, so to speak? That is, made itself available by the vagaries of fate, with no effort on the part of those who can now benefit, with no necessity to strive to bring about its benefits, with no understanding whatsoever of what miraculous mustering of inconceivable forces that must have occurred for such a creature to exist and to present itself for use. The fact of that possibility, or indeed ultimate reality, is exactly what God himself attempts to impress upon Job when the latter is tempted by what does in fact appear to be a rather dismal fate to question the propriety of the cosmic order. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with an hook, or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down? Canst thou put an hook into his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Wilt thou take him for a servant forever? Wilt thou play with him as with a bird, or wilt thou bind him for thy maidens? Shall the companions make a banquet of him? Shall they part him among the merchants? Canst thou fill his skin with barbed irons, or his head with fish spears? Lay thine hand upon him. Remember the battle. Do no more. Behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down, even at the sight of him? None is so fierce that dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand before me? Job 41:1-10. Unwise societies, think Nineveh, take the fact of their traditions and accrued resources for granted. They live unconsciously on the wealth of the past, narcissistically and destructively, consuming more than they earn, even irresponsibly destroying the very spirit whose activity gave rise to the wealth in question. We can regard the wealth offered to us by past and nature alike as our entitlement, even our earned due, and act far too casually and carelessly in consequence, despising our birthright and its source, privilege. This is exactly what is portrayed in the Enuma Elish, the Genesis tale of the ancient Mesopotamians. The careless inhabitants of the first creation kill their father, Apsu, and attempt to live upon or within his dead corpse. Something in the same vein is portrayed in the Disney movie Pinocchio. Midway through the movie, Geppetto, the benevolent father of the movie's marionette hero, finds himself trapped in the belly of a whale, with no real explanation for his predicament offered by the filmmakers, except by implication that the desperate patriarch is willing to search everywhere for his missing son. The carpenter father's loss of the son is equivalent in meaning to Jonah's loss of his living voice, as the son is traditionally the active agent of the father, the eyes or voice of the father, the spirit of what otherwise might be stultified or static tradition. The carpenter father's loss of the son and his consequent grief is a representation of the longing of God for a true covenant or relationship with man. Are we not, in fact, the co-creators of this realm and, perhaps, of heaven itself? We can certainly create hell alone. What could we do if we were instead aligned with the highest we could imagine? Does not the sojourn of the voluntarily unconscious in the belly of the whale signify that those bestowed the unearned benefits of culture and nature can exist blindly and stupidly, in consequence of that unearned largesse, stripping the bodies so provided of their flesh, even living inside their protective and plentiful confines, so to speak, in their bellies? Is that not the same thing as a profound ignorance, ingratitude, arrogance, immaturity, and willful blindness? Is that not the same place as the paternal tent that Abraham dwelt within for so many dependent and infantile decades before embarking on the true adventure of his life? Does this not mean that in developed societies and even successful micro-societies, corporations and other subcultures, The acquisition of wealth over time is likely to enable a collapse of values, the veritable death of God, in consequence of the irresponsibility such wealth allows, however temporarily. Does this all mean, in turn, that the corpses of whales, whether natural or institutional, inevitably become overwhelmed by the willfully blind, painfully unconscious, terminally ungrateful, devouring scavengers that produce nothing but can and will strip everything to its bones, even burning what remains in increasing desperation to ashes? Is it the case, then, to say it slightly differently, that the